Today's Taisho will be on case 32 in the Piyan Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 32 is entitled Joe Joza Stands Still. Ango's Introduction. Once the delusive way of thinking is cut off, a thousand eyes are suddenly opened. One word blocking the stream of thought, and all Nen actions are constrained. Is there anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same life as the Buddha? Truth is manifest everywhere. If you do not see it, here is an ancient example. See the following. Main subject. Jojoza asked Linji, what is the essence of Buddhism? Linji, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jojoza stood still. A monk standing by said, Jojoza, why don't you bow? When Jojoza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. Setcho's verse, inheriting the spirit of Dansai, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kasan, letting the Yellow River run through. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today on this cold winter's morning. I don't have to tell you, because you're here, that when you sit together like this, when we sit together like this, there's a kind of a collective energy that you really can't duplicate when you practice on your own. You know, sitting together creates this collective spirit. You know, the person next to you is sitting still, not moving. And if your legs hurt and you want to move, you look at that person out of the corner of your eye and you realize, I'm going to stay still. And pretty soon you drop down into deep concentration and it's much easier to deal with your discomfort. Maybe it even goes away. We live in a very distracted, confused society at a very very confused and even dangerous time. And very little in our culture encourages us to pursue awakening. You know, it's pretty much all about making money, and if you don't have money, it's important to get money. Getting out of debt is important. All of those things are quite important, but it's really crucial to give yourself time, give yourself permission to do this. You know, I might have mentioned a few weeks ago, I got an email from somebody who said, you know, I want to practice meditation. Every time I practice meditation, I feel better after I do it. But my life is so busy, I barely have time to practice. And he said, I would love to come and sit with your group, but do you have any advice for me? How can I get practice into my life? And, I'm sure his life is very high pressure. I'm sure it's very high pressure. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes people miss sleep and they come to work tired. But, you know, often people get an adequate amount of sleep. And nobody comes to work, without taking a shower. They haven't shaved. They haven't brushed their teeth. Most people come home from work and they watch television for a few hours. So, it's possible, even under very difficult circumstances, to carve out some time to practice. And I suspect that the reason this person doesn't do that is because he doesn't feel he has, you could say, there's this wonderful word in psychotherapy, permission. He doesn't feel like he has permission, right, to come and sit. He feels obligated to spend all of his free time, all of his energy on his job. And even probably when he has the opportunity to relax, he doesn't give himself permission to relax. When I wrote him, I said, I think probably you aren't allowing yourself to practice. It doesn't take so much time out of your day to get up half an hour early and over your lunch break, find a quiet place where you can sit and meditate for 25 minutes or half an hour. I bet you can do this if you want to. The real problem is you don't feel that you have the right to have this in your life. And, that's when you write somebody out of the blue, I don't know this guy. It's kind of a gamble, right? He could have written me back and said, how dare you? You don't know anything about my life. But actually he wrote me back and he said, I actually think you're right. It's so common for people to be, to feel that they can't practice because they don't have permission. It's like, I could be doing something else. I should be doing something else. This is the case in graduate school. If you're in graduate school, basically every spare minute you could be spending on your dissertation or on your research. And anytime you do anything else, you can make yourself feel very guilty. It's like, I'm having a good day, but I should be doing my research. And that sort of spoils everything. And, part of doing well in any area is putting a little pressure on yourself, right? We'd all like to go out and play, but we have to stay and do our homework, right? I mean, that's a basic lesson we learn as kids. You have to do your homework and you can't go out and play with your friends until you do. That's like something you learned when you were in the fifth grade, right? It's definitely the case that if you're going to do something like go to graduate school or if you're in a high-pressure job, your friends all go somewhere and you have to stay and do your reports or do your research and so on. So you do have to sort of close some doors on yourself in some ways. But be careful not to close the really important doors that you should keep open. I'm so glad you gave yourself permission to come here today. There's always something else you can do. But, when you sit down on the cushion with other people and you practice and you enter deep samadhi, it's like nothing else in the world. I think people routinely feel better after meditation. Even if you sit down on the cushion and your head is full of thoughts and you still will get off the cushion in a better place. It's almost always so. When I started practicing Zen in Seattle, I also started graduate school. And I had a lot of pressure, and I would go every morning to the Seattle Zen Center. And my shifu would throw open the windows in the Zen hall every morning. So it would be freezing cold, and I would sit there in the cold and the dark. We would sit just like on a Wednesday night, hour and a half. We'd recite the Heart Sutra, then we'd sit for an hour and a half, and then we'd have a vegetarian breakfast. And every morning I would be sitting there thinking, what am I doing here? I have so much to do. You know, I'd think, oh, I should be writing my dissertation right now. And I could even hear my dissertation director saying, you know, you haven't finished the chapter yet? You know. And I once told him that I did meditation. He said, oh, what a waste of time, you know. So I would sit there on the cushion, and for like the first, say, 10 minutes, it felt like an eternity. I would think, what am I doing here? You know, I should be working on my dissertation. This incredible, like, rush of tension. I just feel, it's like you can't move, but you must move, right? That tension where you're, like, torn in half. And then, you know, I would just realize, look, I'm not going to get up and go now. For one thing, I don't have a ride back to my neighborhood. And so I would just sit there, and after a while, I would just feel so wonderful. And I would be, at the end of the sit, I would be so happy that I did this. And then we'd all have our vegetarian breakfast. This went on and on for like a year. I would get in there, I would be panicked. I was a part of a group of people who would practice together. So there was a professor at the University of Washington who was a brain scientist named John Sunston. And he would pick us up in the morning in his Volkswagen bus. It was like the Zen bus would come by. So we all had to get up. I would get up at 4:30 and take a shower and get ready. And John would come by at 5, and then he would drive down to the Zen Center. There was a kind of camaraderie about it, right? You know, so we would all go down together, and if somebody wasn't there in our group, we'd notice, you know, and people might run into that person and say, where were you this morning? So, I was sick or something. And so it was like nobody wanted to let down the group. You know, so I would sometimes, wake up at 4:30 and just think, oh man, you know, I was up grading papers last night. I'm so tired. You know, why don't I just sleep in? But then I think, well, John is coming to pick me up. And I didn't want John to be disappointed, and I didn't really want to disappoint myself, you know. So I would get up, and then I would go to the Zen Center. I would sit down, and I would think, oh my God, what am I doing here? I should be working on my dissertation, and then I'd be torn in half, and then peace, right? I feel wonderful, you know. And I'm so glad that I didn't sleep in. And I'm so glad that I didn't get off my cushion and run down the street and start working on my dissertation. It's probably the case that when I sat down to write my dissertation, I wouldn't have anything to write anyway, you know? And probably if you're going to write for 3 hours, if you make it 2 hours, you might actually write more. It might be better. So we play all kinds of little games with ourselves, right? But I think in this case, the person who wrote me wasn't giving himself permission to be free. You know, if you want to put it like that, he wasn't giving himself, you know, to be free, to actually do something that he clearly wanted to do. He said, whenever I've meditated, I felt really good. But I, you know, basically what he said is, but I can't, I don't have permission to come and sit with you. So he's really saying, I can't do something I want to do. I have to do something I feel I must do, right? So I hope he comes to sit. He still hasn't shown up, but I'm so glad you gave yourself permission to come here and do this. And it's not just, it's not just that the culture doesn't encourage this, although that's part of it. You know, I've mentioned in the past that in China, in the Tang Dynasty, you know, they actually had, you know, public temples like public schools in the United States. And anybody who wanted to practice meditation could go to a public temple and practice. So, you know, in our culture, we value education very highly. So, you know, I'm an educator, and all of these students are coming as undergraduates, and they're going to go to graduate. Some of them are going to go to graduate school, and they'll become engineers or lawyers or doctors or, and you know, you name it, earth scientists, or you could go on and on. So we respect knowledge very highly, but you know, there are things we've left out of our culture that are really important. You know, so everybody goes to school and studies ideas and, you know, knowledge. But there's actually more to the universe than just that kind of knowledge. And, you know, in the Tang Dynasty, people understood this. You know, even until quite recently, like in places like Tibet, you know, lots of people in Tibet were involved in meditation practices. In fact, before the Cultural Revolution, something like a quarter of all the people in Tibet were living in a monastery. That's a pretty shocking figure. But there was something about it that was attractive to them. And actually, in the Tang Dynasty too, there were very high numbers of people were involved in doing this. You know, it's just the case that you never go into the city and on the side of a bus you see a picture of Guan Yin and it says, "Seek enlightenment today," right? Mostly it wants the thing on the side of the bus, the sign on the side of the bus will try to sell you on something, right? Vacation tours, something like that. So we don't get any reinforcement for doing this, but there's a more important reason why people don't give themselves permission to do this. When you start to meditate, you know, you sit down on the cushion, you straighten your back, you begin to breathe from your dantian, you contract the dantian. And you know, when you first do this, I usually recommend that people count their out-breaths. Follow the out-breaths and count. So the first out-breath is one, the second out-breath is two, the third out-breath is three. And you know, when you're a beginner, people have a lot of difficulty, you know, getting free from their thoughts, right? So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, you might think about all the things you have to do when you leave here. You might replay in your head events related to your job. Maybe you've got a high-pressure situation at your job. Maybe you're rethinking your, you know, vacation last summer. You start replaying tape loops in your head, you know. And it's very difficult at first to get away from those thoughts and move back to your breath. It's like a struggle, right? You start focusing on your breath and then you go back to your thoughts, and you start focusing on your breath and it's like you're dragged over to your thoughts, right? And then you pull yourself back to your breath and then you go back to your thoughts. You know, and your thoughts are so engaging, right? Often, right? They're so compelling. Even if they cause you anxiety, it's hard to get away from them, you know. You think of something, and then that causes an association with something else, and pretty soon you're carried along in this stream of associations, right? And it's very gripping, very sticky or compelling. It's hard to get out of that, you know, and that's interesting, I think. You know, why is it so hard? Because, you know, much of our mental activity doesn't serve any purpose, you know? So if you're a worrier, some people are like worriers. I myself, if it weren't for Zen, I think I would have serious problems with being a worrier. And I know that people in my family were big worriers. So, you know, basically they would sit and just ruminate about problems that might happen or have happened. Right, and just try to turn it over in their minds, right? Very compelling, even though it's not pleasant, right? To ruminating. And people sometimes just can't get out of those cycles of rumination, right? why not? Why is it so hard? You know, often our thinking is not doing any good at all. You know, if you have a problem, like you get a sky-high water bill, and you realize, I'm not using that much water. I must have a leak in my house. You know, that's the kind of problem that can really haunt you all day long. You keep thinking about this, where's the leak? Is it going to be very expensive? Is it the main line? You know, and you can worry, you can lie awake at night and think, oh my God, you know, what if that water bill was huge? You know, if I don't solve this problem, there's no way I can keep paying water bills like that, right? And yet, you know, you can't solve the problem while you're lying down. It would be so nice if we could just say, I'm not going to worry about the water bill right now. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm just going to have a nice sleep. But so difficult to do that, right? You know, I remember when I was just coming here to Rutgers. Rutgers is a rather competitive place, and my department chair told me, when you come up for tenure, you have to have 3 articles that are in prestigious journals. And he gave me a list of journals. And I worked like for a year on this article, and I sent it off to this place, and it got rejected. It got 1 acceptance and 1 rejection. And one guy said, this is a great article. I really like it. It could be improved in this way. And the other guy said, nah, it's not there. I don't think you should publish it. That was torture, right? Because, you know, I would first of all, I felt like calling the editor up and going, please, give me one more chance. He rejected it, you know. And I would lie there and think, but it was almost accepted. You know, what about that guy? He liked it, you know. And I would turn this over in my head. So compelling. When we begin to meditate, we have to deal with the stickiness or the absorbing character of our, not just our mental activity, but even physical things around us. So, you know, beginners, especially if you've been meditating for like, say, 3 to 6 months, maybe a year, you can have a terrible time with ambient noise, right? So when we have our meditation retreats, sometimes there'll be somebody who's new at the retreat, and he'll come into Dokusan and meet me privately, and he'll say, oh my God, the person next to me, he's driving me crazy, right? And I'll say, well, what's going on? He'll say, he's snorting. It's like he's snorting. And the person will make it sound like there's an elephant in the room, right? So, you know, I have actually, sometimes people will complain so much, you know, I'll actually listen, you know, and it's like, there's like a little tiny sniffle, right? Some of you go, you know, you can't hear it very well. I mean, my hearing isn't that great these days, but it's like, it's not, it shouldn't be earth-shattering. But for people who are just beginning, sometimes sounds can be incredibly annoying, right? It's just like, if somebody's moving, it's just like torture. So again, very gripping. And beginning meditation is hard because we spend all of our days in this mental state where we're going from one thing to another, either a physical sensation or an idea or some combination. And the mind goes from this to this to this to this, and it right away. So, you know, basically you get up in the morning, you think, what'll I have for breakfast? Then as you're walking down the stairs, you think about the meeting you have in the morning. Then you look at your refrigerator for something to eat for breakfast. You get out some fruit, maybe, you know, some yogurt, something like that. Then you think, you know, all day long, it's this, 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 this. And this is the normal way people live. You know, in fact, if you say to people what, you know, people don't realize there's anything else to the universe than this, 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 this. And it's partly cultural, and it's partly the way maybe we're wired, I don't know. But when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to follow the breath, you know, first it's a struggle to get away from this thought, and then the sensation of pain in your knee, and then the sound of the fan, and then somebody sniffling, and then, you know, and so on. It's very difficult, but eventually people can develop what's called one-pointed attention on the breath. And now you're focusing on the breath, and everything's going pretty well. You know, the thoughts recede to sort of the margin of your attention. And at the forefront of your attention is the breath. And now this is like an ideal situation. You come back to the breath. And if you do this for just a little while, your anxiety level will drop down a lot. And you'll begin to experience like this deep relaxation response. And this can happen with great regularity. If you practice, every time you sit down on the cushion, you can pretty much get to this place where you have this deep relaxation response. But then, you know, if you keep watching the breath, something interesting is going to happen to you. And I can give it away because, you know, it won't, if you can't get there yet, it won't help you. And if you've been there, then this is old news. When you're watching the breath, at some point, you follow the breath out. And you'll notice that at the end of the breath, there's an empty space. There's a blank space. Or another way to put it is, if you focus on any object of attention for any length of time, it will disappear. It will just seem to disappear. So different ways of putting it. But if you follow the breath out and you follow the breath out and you follow the breath out, you'll notice at the end of the breath, your mind is blank. Or empty. It's like turning off the TV and your computer and you're staring at a blank screen. You know, normally on your computer screen there's words or there's images, or on your phone there are the news feeds or movies you watch on the bus. If you turn it off and you look at the blank screen, sometimes, if you're doing your meditation, you follow the breath out, suddenly you look at the screen and it's blank. The screen of your mind. It's like you have a screen in your head, so to speak. And if you look at that screen, it's just blank. Some people experience it as sort of blank and somewhat bright, and some people experience it as blank and somewhat dark. Or if you watch the breath, it'll just seem to disappear. If you have any kind of awareness, a sensation, and you focus on it, even like if you hear a bird outside, if you're listening to, sometimes when people are meditating, there's ambient noise like birds, you know. If you listen to a bird who's repetitively chirping, you know, at some point the chirp will just totally disappear, and your mind will just go totally blank. You know, now this is incredibly important. This is incredibly important. You know, at first it might seem trivial. You know, you're watching the breath, and suddenly the mind goes blank, and then you immediately start thinking again. It's typical, right? You have this experience of blankness, and then you think, oh yeah, what am I going to eat for lunch, you know? And then it's forgotten almost. But, you know, if you keep meditating, you keep coming back to this blank place. And at first, the blank place is just like that. It's here and it's gone. You might not even notice it the first time. But eventually, you'll notice that it's not so small or brief as you thought. You know, you get back to that blankness and you begin to realize it's rather large and inexhaustible, actually. So when you're able to do that, the teacher will generally assign you, instead of telling you to watch your breath, the teacher will generally assign you the koan mu, or u, meaning not or nothing. So instead of watching the breath, on your out-breath you say u, or mu. Mu is Japanese, wu or u is Mandarin. Ooh. So you just say, the point is to say the word on the out-breath, and to focus on the sound, or the word rather, just the word, as you're breathing out so completely that no other thoughts can arise. And when you get to the end of your breath, usually your mind will become blank. That screen in your head will become blank. You know, this is it seems trivial. And you can practice Zen for a long time before you realize how important this really is. You know, sometimes if you've been practicing, say, for a number of years, say 6, 7, 8, 9 years, you begin to notice something. You might sooner or later notice something. Consciousness seems to be continuous. In other words, there's this, and there's this, and there's this, and there's this. So consciousness seems to have no breaks in it, right? So you have a thought, what am I going to eat for lunch when I leave here? And then you think about restaurants, and then you realize you have pain in your knee. And then you hear the fan, and then you have pain in your hip. And then you hear, you know, somebody next to you quietly shuffling around on the cushion, right? You know, this sort of thing. This and this and this and this and this, you know. And people think that's all there is. But, you know, when you really are in deep concentration for a long time, sooner or later you will see that it's not really like that. You know, it's like there's something and then there's nothing. There's something and there's nothing. There's something. In other words, between our moments of experiencing something, the sound, the pain in our leg, the idea, there's like little tiny spaces that we don't pay attention to, we ignore. But they're really there. And if you meditate long enough, they'll become absolutely obvious to you. You know, if you've ever, you know, we live in a digital age now, but when I was growing up, when you went to a movie theater, they would have a projector, and in the projector was actually a cellulose tape. It was a tape, like a plastic tape, and the plastic tape would be drawn through a stream of light, and that stream of light would go into a lens and it would go out into the movie theater and project. And because this was like a spool of film or a big wheel of tape with images on it, it was vulnerable to overheating. So when they would start a movie, they would take this big tape, a big film, and put it onto these spools, and then they would pull it through the lamp, as it was called, the projecting bulb, and the light would go through the negative, through this tape, and project the image out on the screen, see? Frame by frame. So if you look at these movies, they have a frame and another frame and another frame and another frame. And when the projector was operating properly, you don't notice that the images on the screen are not continuous. So, you know, if a car is driving down the street, it just drives down the street. But if something began to go wrong with the projector, the tape in the projector would begin to slow down, and you would see, sometimes you could see that there was actually a picture of a car, another picture of a car, another picture of a car, another picture of a car. Each picture's a little different. But when you run them at high speed, you don't notice that they're individual photos. It just seems like a smooth image of the car going down the street. But when the when the tape is getting too hot, the projector begins to slow down, and you can see the individual frames in the movie. This doesn't happen anymore, I think, because they have a different technology. But it was quite shocking to me as a child to suddenly realize, you know, when I'm watching a movie, the movie begins to slow down, the sound slows down like this, right? And then you see the individual images, and you realize what you're seeing isn't continuous. It's a series of single shots run together very quickly, and the mind takes out the spaces. Well, this is exactly what the mind does all the time. It takes out the spaces. But actually, those spaces are really there, and they're very important. So, when we go through the day, we have learned how to ignore the little spaces between this and this and this. And when we do meditation, you know, we're actually focusing on our consciousness as it moves from moment to moment so carefully that we begin to put the spaces back in. I hope this is making some sense. You know, when you watch the breath and you watch the next breath and the watch the next breath, that's like watching frames in a movie. And you begin to notice as you're watching the breath that at the end of the breath there's a little blankness. And at the next end of the next breath there's a little blankness. See, you're beginning to notice the blank spaces. This probably sounds, if you haven't had these experiences, this might sound a little far-fetched. But, you know, the Buddhist point of view is that we see half the reality because we only focus on this and this and this and ignore the spaces. See, we have a highly distorted picture of reality, and maybe it's our culture and maybe it's our evolution, but that we're not taking in the whole picture most of the time. We're focusing on half the picture. You know, in a very famous, there's a very famous poem a Chinese Chan master wrote, and it can be translated in English as the poem of the matching halves, matching H-A-L-V-E-S, halves, right? So, you know, it's like you have a movie where an old coin has been broken in two, right? And a brother has one coin and the sister has the other coin. And they go through all these adventures looking for each other, and at the end they meet each other and each person reaches into the pocket and takes out the coin and they put the coins together and they match. And you realize, ah, my brother and my sister, see? Well, our experience of reality is like we only see one half of that coin all the time. And it greatly distorts our understanding of the world. It's like we have a cognitive defect that prevents us from seeing half of what's going on all the time, or seeing how things fit together. And I know this sounds far-fetched, but if you meditate long enough, it's absolutely clear. It's so obvious, it's inescapable. And it makes, as I say, it's hugely important and it makes a huge difference. It's like we get half the story all the time. It would be like listening to somebody talk. It's like that. It's the experiential counterpart of that, right? That's all we see. See, half the picture all the time. So, you know, and we have a long history in Western culture, has a long history of not liking emptiness, right? And emptiness in the West is bad, right? It's depressing or frightening. But Asian cultures in India and China were much more receptive to the importance of emptiness. See, Lao Tzu says, you know, a wheel only turns because it's empty at the center. The emptiness makes something else possible. See, that's Lao Tzu. But we Western people don't think that way. But whether you're Eastern or Western, it's hard to notice the empty spaces. But when you put the empty spaces in, it's like two sides of a coin coming together at long last. You get the whole picture. See? So, we live in a world that's, from the Buddhist standpoint, incredibly distorted and misleading, because we're not taking in all the information, the whole picture. And when we do Zen practice, we're learning what we're missing. We're restoring the missing half to our experience. It's like there's a little song called Synchronicity by the Police. I don't know if anybody knows the Police. They were a big rock group when I was young. But they have a little, there's a line in their, one of their songs that says, the connecting principle has to be invisible. Well, the connecting principle doesn't have to be invisible, but it is invisible to us, at least until we do a lot of zazen. But the connecting principle is, we call mu, or we call u. And it's like not being able to see the whole picture. Our perception of the sutras say human perception of the world is, they often say, upside down. We have what the sutras call upside down views. And I would put it a little differently. We have half the picture all the time. And if you don't give yourself permission to practice Zen, you will live in that half the picture world all your life. It's funny, isn't it? Sometimes life seems so lifeless, right? Our existence seems so lifeless. You know, you get up and you go to your job, and it's like the same old job. You know, it's the same office, the same, you know, people. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, right? It's just like, it's no matter what you do, it seems rather joyless and lifeless, right? And then on another day, you know, you could come into your office and everything seems so alive. It's the same office. It's the same people, right? You know, what makes the difference? Is it, you know, the Zen standpoint would be somehow, you know, a little bit of emptiness got into that. It got into you, you know. You know, sometimes, you know, just getting out of your rut can give you a fresh perspective. And sometimes people give themselves a chance to have an experience with that emptiness. So, you know, when you go out into the woods, if you like to hike or you're outside, you're walking along a river, you listen to the water, you know, breaking on the stones, you hear the wind overhead, something very interesting generally happens to people. They stop thinking. You know, suddenly, you know, your mind just begins to enter a kind of like natural blankness. You know, and it's possible that our ancestors lived with this blankness much more often than we do just by being out in nature. You know, when you're, you know, it's one of the reasons people like nature but might not even know why they like it. If you said to somebody, I know why you like nature, it gives you access to that emptiness. You know, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. But they might, you know. When you're out in that world, your mind begins to stop focusing on ideas and it becomes blank and you experience things suddenly as being very lively. You know, if you're highly distracted and somebody serves you a delicious meal, you know, you might not even taste it, right? But, you know, if you go to Sesshin, you know, people always who go, I hope everybody in this room will go to Sesshin at some point, hopefully soon. But, you know, if you go to Sesshin, people who go will say, oh, the food is so delicious, and it is delicious. But we have a secret weapon. It's called emptiness, you know. If you've been sitting with emptiness all day and you eat a plate of beans, it's like ambrosia, right? It's just like, this is the most amazing food I've ever had. And everything takes on that character because you're restoring the missing half. You know, what makes our lives so dead is that we go from this to this to this to this, and it's like we cut ourselves off from that mu energy. You know, you could think of emptiness as like the energy in the universe, right? It's like when the energy in the universe congeals or becomes rigid and fixed, we call it a thing. But when it's flowing freely, it takes this form and that form and this form and that form. In constant, it's like a symphony of change. So actually, nothing is a thing. Everything is a rise. It's like everything is like a wave. It's arising and cresting and then receding back into the ocean. Everything is like that, according to the Buddhist view. And if you meditate long enough, it's absolutely obvious. But when we only see half the picture, everything takes on this fixity or heaviness or semi-permanence, and the life drains out of it, and it becomes a dead object. See. So you know, when you begin to put the emptiness back, everything comes to life, and something else amazing happens. You know, the connecting principle is invisible. You know, when we live in a world of this and this and this, things begin to feel very separate from us, very separate. Everything is separate because we're only seeing half the picture. It's like a wave looking at another wave and not noticing they're part of the same ocean. It's like, what's that over there? It's some wave. You know, those guys are jerks. I'm the only good wave, right? You know. So you know, people tend to think that way. You look at another wave and you think, well, that's not me. That's somebody else, right? But actually, you know, when you put the connecting principle back, you realize, oh my gosh, that's me. And it will happen to you if you do mu meditation on the cushion. You know, you get off the cushion, you go outside, and everything is... In the Diamond Sutra, it says it's like a great body. One great body. This is one great body. We're all waves on one great ocean. And it sounds like philosophy or science fiction because we don't put the connecting principle back. But Zen practice starts with putting it back, right? This emptiness meditation is suddenly, it's like the missing half. Or the connecting principle. Suddenly, everything is connected. Everything is alive. So, in this little story, Jojo Za is a senior monk. And Lin Ji is the Shifu at this temple. And Jojo Za has been sitting for 20 years, but he's never noticed Wu. And that Wu is the connecting principle that holds everything together. It's like everything is just this life energy flowing like a wave rising up and going back into the ocean. He just sees this and this and this and this for 20 years. So Jojo Za says to Lin Ji, what is the essence of Buddhism? And Lin Ji says, you know, basically, he grabs him and slaps him, see? But actually, slapping him is not supposed to punish him. It's not about being cruel. It's not about hurting him. It's about making him aware of the empty space, right? You know, right after that, there's an empty space, yeah? I've sort of told you, but if you watch your mind when you hear something like that, right after that, there's a blank space. Yes? So, same thing. If somebody slapped your face, please don't slap my face. I won't slap your face. But it's an emergency. This guy's been sitting for 20 years and he hasn't noticed the connecting principle. So he says, what is the essence of Buddhism? And just then, Jojo Za notices that empty space right after that, right? And So Linji rose from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jojo Za stood still. It's like emptiness, right? And then the monk says, Jojo Za, why don't you bow? And Jojo Za, when he bows, it's like form and emptiness come together. And it, when form and emptiness come together, it's like the two halves of this coin. And I won't tell you what he sees next, but if you practice Zen, you will find out for yourself.